Welcome to the Dazer update for April 12th, 2015. This is the Skype Happens edition of the show. I'm Filippo D'Alfo.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
I'm the new guy.
Leland.
Yeah. And we hate the internet.
Yeah. And we had about 15, 20 minutes of nice discussion about what we were playing, but Skype decided we didn't deserve that, so we can't have it. So let's just jump right into what's releasing this week. There's only one real title of note that everybody's looking forward to, and that's Mortal Kombat.
Oh, yeah. Yay!
Yeah.
Oh, man, I am so freaking excited for this.
Yeah.
I guess I'm the only one that isn't.
Really?
And I actually, help run fighting game tournaments.
And what is it that's not grabbing you about it?
I actually have a pretty big issue with the monetization behind the game. Like we're getting DLC characters announced before the game's even out, and
season pass is ungodly expensive.
Yeah, isn't the season pass like $50?
Yeah,
that.
Which I think we're sort of at this point where a lot of developers have to try and wring out as much money out of the game as they can, and I think especially for something like fighting games, which is definitely still more of a niche than I think a lot of people would want, it's still really disappointing, at least for me, to sort of feel like I'm getting gouged. And so what that's actually doing is I'll eventually get it, because I have friends go play it and all that stuff, but I'm going to be one of those people that waits till the, Game of the Year edition that has everything in it anyway, and it's going to cost what it should cost initially out the door.
Yeah.
I think it looks
really
great.
Lead editions.
Yeah.
There's definitely value there, but I'm not going to blow $110, $115 on a fighting game, or any game, really.
Yeah. The good news, though, I will admit, the DLC characters they got announced actually are pretty awesome. I mean, it's freaking Jason Voorhees.
Oh, yeah. No, that's certainly
and
cool.
And Predator.
It's certainly cool, and it definitely kind of fits the motif of Mortal Kombat anyway, but I kind of feel like that DLC model really hit its zenith with Cross Tekken, where you had everyone on the disc, and Capcom was just going to gouge people down the line. It's gross. It feels dirty to me.
You know, because that worked really well for Capcom.
Exactly, and I feel like this will work better for Mortal Kombat simply because I think more people are willing to jump on it because they're like, oh shit, the Predator, Jason Voorhees, this is stuff we haven't seen done to this extent. So I think it can definitely be successful for them. But
the closest we've got was the last Mortal Kombat where they had Freddy Krueger.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, but the season pass is outrageous, and I'm kind of a bit burnt on previous season passes as well. So I'm kind of I'm really kind of moving away from putting down money on something where I don't really know what the completed product is going to be.
Yeah.
All right. On to more pleasant speaking, though.
I was just going to say, Jesus Christ, what would have happened if Soul Calibur 2 came out today instead of 12 years ago?
Oof.
No kidding.
Damn.
Yeah, there's a game.
I just had to put that out there.
Microtransaction to death.
Oh, God. Yeah.
How much do you think they would have been able to juice people for Link?
$10 and people would have
paid. Oh, yeah. They probably would have been able to get $10 or $15 just from the people that are like the Super Nintendo hardcores that'll pay for anything.
Yeah.
But as I was saying, Mortal Kombat is a franchise I've been with pretty much since the first game. I can still very clearly remember when I was first introduced to Mortal Kombat. There was a bowling alley that used to be with us. It was called the Macon Bowl. And I remember once we went down there and I saw Mortal Kombat over there. The first one, the original one.
Right.
Now, in hindsight, we can kind of see that the original Mortal Kombat has some really serious flaws with it.
Yeah.
Its gameplay is noticeably inferior to Street Fighter 2.
Yes, absolutely.
The control, it was kind of floaty. The controls were kind of flumsy and slow. but to be honest, that wasn't the reason you played Mortal Kombat to begin with.
No.
Especially not the first game. The reason you played Mortal Kombat was because you were on the playground the other day, and one of the people you were hanging around at the monkey bars with said, "Hey, if you played with the blue ninja dude and you do this and this, he'll rip the dude's head off." And you're like, nuh-uh, they wouldn't do that in a game. He's like, "No, go, seriously." And then you go and over there, and then you play as Sub-Zero, and sure enough, he rips that dude's head clean off his damn shoulders, and the spinal cord is still attached to it. Yeah. And you're like, "Whoa, no way."
Well, and I think
radical, because it was the early 90s, and we all talk like that.
Yeah, exactly. Mortal Kombat at the time, too, with that gore, really, really kind of thrived as an alternative to Street Fighter because it was so very different. It definitely didn't have the mechanics Street Fighter had, but then you take that edge to it, too, with it being the 90s and people going, "Holy crap, they can do that in games?"
Yeah. Well, on top of that, you also have to remember, this was the game
you first played it.
Yeah. Also, you got to... This was also, you got to remember, it was also the digitized graphics, too, which, you know...
Looked fantastic.
Today, we... Yeah, they looked fantastic back then.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we look at it and it looks kind of silly. But the truth of the matter is, I don't think Mortal Kombat as a franchise really hit its stride until Mortal Kombat 2.
Yeah.
Because Mortal Kombat 2 took all the stuff with Mortal Kombat 1, and basically it perfected everything that was good about Mortal Kombat 1 and pretty much fixed most of everything that was wrong with the first one.
Yeah.
You got more characters, more finishing moves. The overall art direction was just better. The character art was cleaner.
Yeah.
You know,
a better game overall.
Yeah, and I
can
remember
still play
that
to this day. That's the thing, it's a great game.
Yeah.
It's a little slow, but
Yeah.
Well, again, this is the one problem with the first couple of Mortal Kombat games was that the controls were kind of floaty. But the difference was it wasn't as bad in Mortal Kombat 2.
Yeah.
It was a much tighter experience overall. And again, I saw Mortal Kombat 2 at the bowling alley, and it completely blew me away because it was everything that was the first Mortal Kombat turned up to 11.
Yeah,
I mean, it was gorier. It was darker overall. I mean, really, between Mortal Kombat and Mortal Kombat 2, Mortal Kombat 2 was a really dark game.
Yeah.
Well, didn't the original Mortal Kombat, at least for the consoles, I believe, that was the reason why we ended up with a rating system.
Yep. Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
That and Night Trap.
Nintendo went one way, Sega went another, and... Yep.
Sega ended up being proven right because by the time Mortal Kombat 2 came out, you know, any Nintendo just said, screw it.
Yeah.
Sega launched their own ratings board, and that sort of, it didn't evolve into the ESRB, but it definitely laid the groundwork for what would become the ESRB.
Yeah.
They really followed Sega's model to the letter.
You had Mortal Monday as well for the console releases. I mean, it was sort of a pioneer in that instance for getting people hyped up and bringing that stuff out. And even with the arcade games where they would regularly release version updates and they would add stuff, they would iteratively add stuff to the games was really interesting.
Yeah.
You know, of course, that was back when arcades were still in their heyday.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, it was really crazy, especially between Mortal Kombat 2 and Mortal Kombat 3. I think... You know, Mortal Kombat fever was at its pitch.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was during that time we got comic books, we got, you know, movies, we got the Saturday morning cartoon,
which we shall try to forget.
To see them do that kind of stuff, like something that's obviously an R-rated property that then gets a TV show for children. Like they did it with like RoboCop, remember that?
Yeah.
They tried to do, and they did it with the Toxic Avenger.
They even did it with Police Academy.
Yeah.
Well, Police Academy, I can kind of see that. But they also did it with, they tried to do it with Darkstalkers.
Yeah, it didn't work.
I don't know if
Street Fighter had its horrible series, too.
Yeah.
They took away Felicia's boobs. That's just that should be a crime against humanity. But obviously by the time Mortal Kombat 4 came out, the series just wasn't what it had been.
Four was just bad.
You hear Ed Boon talk about it. There was so much bullshit going on in the development of that game.
Keep in mind, right around the time that game was in development, John Tobias was trying to do Mortal Kombat Mythology Sub-Zero, and that one also turned out to be a disaster.
Yeah. Well, it was just one of those things they were trying to expand out the franchise into other things, which actually Shaolin Monks wasn't that bad.
Shaolin Monks is actually pretty solid.
But the switch to 3D really, I think, really hurt them, and I don't think they got their footing back for quite some time.
They tried with Deadly Alliance and stuff, but that didn't work quite well either.
No, but Deadly Alliance did, kind of lay the groundwork for what we ended up with. But Deception ended up being pretty good. Armageddon was just too much. There was just too much.
I would admit, was very obviously rushed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there was Mortal Kombat versus DC Universe, which I don't think made any sense whatsoever. So.
Yeah.
Which leads us to the last two games of the series, which were a successful reboot with 9.
See, I was justified absolutely as the iron-fisted Mortal Kombat hater all through those years.
Yeah.
And then you get Ed Boon and his team, NetherRealm Studios, out from under Midway, and they prove themselves to be some of the, just as good of minds in fighting game development as you see at Capcom. You just really had to get him away from Midway, out from under whatever corporate meddling was going on over there, and that turned Mortal Kombat into a franchise that your more serious fighting gamer could actually respect and invest in.
It was a financial windfall, too, because that freaking game sold like crazy when it came out.
Yeah, it did.
I mean, it completely proved, that Mortal Kombat was not only still relevant, but was not just a gimmick. It was a serious contender for fighting game.
And I think, actually, you can attribute a lot of that to Ed Boon. Like, I met him at Evolution one year.
Good dude.
He is. He's a really solid dude. But what's interesting, even if you look at like the timeline from Mortal Kombat 1 all the way to what they're doing now, he's very invested in what the fans think and what they want and in trying to kind of maneuver around that. And I think he has a level of engagement that you don't particularly see from a lot of creators in the fighting game community. Like, even someone like – I think probably the only person that's close to him would be Harada, the guy that did Tekken. I met him this year at Final Round when he brought Tekken 7. And those two guys, Ed Boon and Harada, seem very similar in the sense that they definitely want to hear what the fans want, and they try to move towards that. And I don't think you would have that resurgence if Ed Boon was creating the kind of game that he thought fans wanted rather than actually listening to them.
Yeah.
Part of what was really cool about Mortal Kombat 9 amongst other things, obviously the first thing was Mortal Kombat, of course, obviously by Mortal Kombat 9 had gotten back to its 2D roots, obviously because it's still a 3D game, but now that they exclusively put gameplay on a 2D plane, that meant that they could put all of the rest of that graphical power in, the backgrounds and the arena design, and it paid off really well, I think. They did some astonishingly beautiful scenery for that game.
They have always had fantastic art direction as well.
Yeah, and actually, I didn't know this. John Tobias was the primary art director for the games, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, did you know he was, before he went on Mortal Kombat, he was a comic book artist?
Absolutely no surprise there.
Yeah, he was the primary artist for the real Ghostbusters comic book. And in fact, do you remember the promotional comic books that came out for Mortal Kombat 1 and 2?
Yeah.
He did those too. In fact, he pretty much any type of comic booky art that came out, any type of character art or stuff, promotional artwork that you got in magazines or promotional materials, he did.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But anyway, I was talking about the 2D thing. another great thing was, if you noticed, one of the things about the Mortal Kombat 9 is that, and actually this goes for sort of the whole Mortal Kombat franchise, one of the things that, because obviously Mortal Kombat, most of it existed before the internet was a big thing. Mortal Kombat 3...
For what it was doing at the time.
Yeah, for its sort of its aura of mystery. Yeah. And what would happen is all these rumors would start going around for all these different, you know, like Mortal Kombat 2, like, you know, there was rumors for example, in Mortal Kombat 2, one of the rumors that kept going around was that if you did so-and-so in the Living Forest stage, that you could knock your opponent into one of the tree's mouths and they'd eat it.
Yeah, I remember
that.
And
that totally happens in Mortal Kombat 9.
Yeah.
That is something you can completely do.
Well, that started with Reptile with 1, and then, you know, there was the rumors of Ermac, which was really it was either earnings per machine or the error registry, one of the two. And of course they ended up turning that into a character as well. They're very, very, again, coming back to like being engaged with the fans, they're very aware of what gets talked about, which is really interesting.
Yeah, I think they were kind of on the cutting edge back then.
They were invested in the fan base from the very beginning.
Yeah. The other thing that Mortal Kombat 9 did really well is that it rebooted the whole franchise and streamlined the whole lore into a much more sensible form. You know, they basically redid a bunch of lore. They made Nightwolf part of the whole story from the beginning instead of an add-on in 3. You know, it made sense for once. And, it's, you know, but what's going to happen is, you know, Mortal Kombat X is supposed to be, essentially, it's supposed to be the sequel to Mortal Kombat 9, and it's supposed to take place, like, I think some 20-something years after Mortal Kombat 9, so...
Well, a span of time ranging up to 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, it actually looks kind of like they're still sort of doing Mortal Kombat 9 in the spirit of what Mortal Kombat 2 was, because again, we've got a sequel that is noticeably much, much darker than its predecessor. Everything from the actual character designs, the set designs, you know, everything just looks darker and more menacing. Overall. So I've got very high expectations for this game, and I'm pretty sure it's going to meet most of them. I can't wait.
If it's following up on MK9, it has to be good.
Yeah.
And from what I've seen, it looks like they've really sort of tightened up a lot of stuff.
Says a lot. MK9 had a little bit of Virtua Fighter in it, if you ask me. Everything about the way you execute combos and the way everything just blends together seamlessly just feels perfect. And they're tightening up on that. I can't wait to play this game.
Yeah. Well, we've only got a couple of days to wait, so let's...
One person pointed out to me that, you know, one of the things, obviously, you know, some of the characters like Johnny Cage and Sonya, obviously, they'll be back. They'll be in middle. Yeah, well, I mean, they'll be middle aged now because, you know, they have their daughter is in the game. A couple of the Kano will be there. Kitana, of course, will be coming back. And somebody pointed out, you know, and I had a friend of mine said, Kitana doesn't look like she's 40-something years old. I'm like, well, you got to remember, people in Outworld, they age slower.
Yeah.
Like, I think she was like 100-something years old in her original appearance. So.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, we might as well just dedicate all of next week's show to it.
Make it the Mortal Kombat episode.
Yeah. The Mortal Kombat Skype crashes all the time episode.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that's just this episode.
Hopefully I'll be able to figure that out by next week.
God damn it.
Yeah, they're just, you know, we're just getting a Skype keeps getting fatality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll, so, jump into our
for the actual news.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to start us off, Pat?
Don Matrick just graduated from another gaming company. Apparently, having proven too awesome for EA and Microsoft, now, now he's graduating from Zynga.
Yeah, he's just getting off that sinking ship.
Building the resume.
If there, I don't blame him. That if there is one, if there is. There is very few gaming companies that are more loathsome than Zynga.
Yeah.
And King, the only one other than that would be King. Yeah. And
well, I think, I know it's really easy to be very hyperbolic about Matrick. I think a very large part of the problem that the Xbox One is having has to do with the fact that when Matrick took over and you know the 360 sort of had the shift, they kind of gave the edge back to Sony, and then Sony capitalized on that with the PlayStation 4. But I think a big part of this is also happening because it's strictly a money issue. Like one of the things that Matrick was able to do was to diversify what the Xbox brand meant to a lot of people, and I think you sort of see that extended to, like, remember when they announced the Xbox One, they didn't even show games at first. They showed stuff like you can use it with your cable box, the NFL Network, like all this stuff. And a lot of that was
TV.
A lot of that was Matrick. And I think that a big reason that he most likely got that job at Zynga was because Zynga did need to diversify. I think when he came on, I don't have any of the figures in front of me, but I know that their growth rate pretty much had tanked. And I understood that under him, it kind of picked back up. And Zynga was a company that, whether you like them or not, you know, I definitely don't think that they're a good company. But, you know, they brought Matrick in to give them a shot in the arm that they'll keep their shareholders happy. And it appears like he was able to do that. I was reading some figures that, like, he upped their fill rate and a bunch of other things by, like, 60%. And then, you know, he's handing it back over. So it might have only been a sort of a temporary position in the first place. But it's going to be interesting to see what he does going forward, because I think – if you look at the industry, at least the console industry currently, his ideas, I think, have been roundly rejected. Yeah. But they do seem like, for the things that he would want to do, they would multiply greatly and gain a ton of traction in the mobile space, which is scary in and of itself. But it'll be interesting to see what he does going forward, because, like the guy or not, he's definitely the reason why we saw the shift with Microsoft and the Xbox. And you know, if he keeps bouncing around to these mobile companies, I mean, mobile gaming could turn into something much uglier than it is now.
Well, wish him well and see what happens there.
Yeah, I mean, I know he's probably going to be starving for a while.
You
know?
Oh, yeah.
Guys like that don't get paid a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess we'll just go right into the Xbox 360 story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, now that we're ass deep in the next generation of consoles, the Xbox 360 is now getting the support for up to 2 terabyte external drives that we really could have used back in 2007.
Yeah, well, back in 2007, I don't know that we were really downloading a whole heck of a lot.
Yeah, that was kind of a rough estimate, I suppose, but. I remember that my 20 gig drive certainly was, or whatever the hell I got with my launch system, was starting to stretch a little bit thin. But in all honesty, this is a good move. It's going to considerably help the, I guess, post-support lifespan of the Xbox 360, and you know, downloadable games have become a pretty big thing. In the intervening years, and so this it stopped being optional a long time ago. But this is just this is something that's going to help the Xbox 360 remain relevant as the new systems get their foothold.
Yeah, so, I mean, you could pick up a 2 terabyte drive for about $100, and since Microsoft is giving away a lot of pretty big retail games for the Xbox 360, it kind of makes sense that they would put that in at some point. Yep.
And for 360, yeah, they're yours to keep, so.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, I'm glad they did that, because what I found myself doing towards the end of the 360 generation was really, I the minute they gave me the option to install the games, the disc didn't spin, and it didn't sound like my 360 was a jet engine. I was all over it.
Yeah.
And so just the idea that because I have a 250 in my Slim, and I have a 320 upstairs.
Right.
So the fact that I can now just do a drive and leave it, you know, kind of sit, because I've been actually kicking around the idea, like, do I want to swap out the 320 drive, and then I got to install everything, and I just haven't done it. So the fact that I can actually just put an extra hard drive on it and leave it down there, to me, since there's no backwards compatibility, it's really great that I know that my 360 will be around considerably longer because I'm not putting more wear and tear on it.
Yeah.
My backlog's huge.
Yeah, it's getting huge. Bigger and bigger every month with all the crap that they keep giving us.
Yeah.
Well, it's not even that, man. Like, there's good stuff coming out.
Yeah.
There's still good stuff coming out, and I didn't have a lot of opportunity. I didn't get to play nearly as much on the last gen as I wanted to. So I have, like, this kind of, like, I've got a stack literally, like, 50 games sitting in the corner. And stuff that I just picked up when it was cheap. And so it's one of those things, especially with this generation not having too much that's all that interesting to me right now. It's finally giving me a chance to catch up. So the fact that I don't have to really worry about data management is awesome.
Yeah.
What
type of stuff did you get?
What was that?
What type of stuff did you get? Yeah, what type of stuff did you get? You said you got a stack of like 50.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just
a lot of it. Give us a general idea.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of it is like, you know, some – let me take a look here. I'm going to turn around here. All right. Well, some of it was stuff I got like to play with my kid, like mini ninjas and stuff like that. But I have other stuff that I picked up on, you know, on the cheap that I never got the opportunity to play. Stuff like the Saboteur, which I know is a solid game. It really didn't get a lot of, I think I got like sevens and stuff when it came out.
It's a solid game, but it's loaded with glitches and bugs. That's the primary problem with it.
Well, yeah, I got, you know, I even have some of the indie stuff that did like Shadow Complex and everything. I'm sitting here looking. I've just got so I haven't played through the Dead Space games. I still haven't finished Darksiders 2. Gears of War 2, Gears of War 3. Because of having my kid. I'm one of those parents. Like, you know, you always hear those irresponsible parents that are like, "Yeah, I bought my kid Grand Theft Auto and he's murdering hookers and I'm fine with it." I'm not one of those parents. I'm really, really, really conscientious about what my kid sees.
Yeah.
You couple that with work life and couple that with like the small little window that I have to play because I still have to, you know, spend time with my wife and do all that other stuff. So these bigger releases that I can't play in smaller chunks, I just have not gotten around to. And it's, so the backlog kind of just piled up. So I'm starting to finally slowly clear it out. I'm almost done with BioShock Infinite. So this is the opportunity to do all that. So yeah.
Are you relatively aware of how BioShock Infinite ends?
No, I'm not.
Prepare to have your brain sort of
twisted
seat out of your ears because it gets kind of complicated.
I'm fascinated by the time period that they're using, particularly because the 1910s, 1920s, that whole era, you don't really see anybody really go into that. Nothing in popular culture really reflects that. And again, like I said, I was able to avoid a lot of spoilers, but the idea that Booker was with the Pinkertons and the history that's behind some of that stuff is fascinating. So I'm really curious to see in which direction it goes. Cause you know, he blew everybody's minds all over the floor with the first BioShock. So I'm really looking forward to finishing.
See, here's the thing. I've actually read Atlas Shrugged twice. Into the original BioShock, I had a pretty good idea of where we were coming from.
The thing I would tell you
about BioShock Infinite is that as far as the ending is concerned, ultimately it's not about the where, it's about the why. Yeah. And you'll understand that when it happens.
Well, I just appreciate the fact, like, I remember my wife my wife has always been into gaming, but it's sort of been like a side thing. She doesn't play the kind of games that you know, the average gamer does. And I remember she did watch me play BioShock and everything, and she was fascinated with the original one. And we talked a lot about that stuff, and I was also just fascinated by it simply because, you know, he took basically the idea of Atlas Shrugged and took it to its endpoint. And, you know, I won't spoil it for anybody that might be listening and hasn't finished it, but that game, like when you get to the twist in the first BioShock, like that made me incredibly uncomfortable. I felt like it was one of those moments where if you wanted to point someone towards gaming and go, this is something gaming can do that a book can't do, that a TV show can't do, that a movie can't do, that happens in that first BioShock. And so I was just that was one of those games where I just sat down and I've played it multiple times and just kind of deconstructed it. And I know it doesn't get that deep in Infinite, but when I started playing Infinite originally, it really made me uncomfortable, just like the racism.
When you're dealing with that time period, the racism is something you sort of have to take with it.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. The truth,
because America was very, very racial back then, and it was, and it's surprising. It reminds you of just the type of stuff that in our modern progressive era we would consider horrifically offensive was actually pretty common back then.
Yeah, well, and what's interesting to me as well, like when you, because of course, you know, you and I were both from Georgia, so we have remnants of that crap here now. But my wife is Puerto Rican. She's Hispanic. So, and I'm a white guy. So I'm acutely aware of like when certain things present themselves, especially when you've lived in the South for so long and that kind of racism is sort of ingrained.
Let me just put it this way for all of you folks who are listening out here. Up until fairly recently, we had an elementary school that was named after General Nathan Bedford Forrest, the original Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. So let me just give you an idea about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's one of those things, you know, just where it surrounds you. So seeing it in a lens, particularly in a video game format, is very interesting. So I'm actually planning on finishing that this weekend.
Okay.
Cool.
Just so you know, BioShock Infinite, there's also the Buried at Sea DLC, which actually takes place in Rapture.
So if you want to get
a hold of that, I actually recommend it because it's also pretty mind-blowing in itself.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because I got the game. I bought it, and then I know we got it on, I could swear, unless I'm mistaken, it came out on Games for Gold.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah, because that was like, oh man, I'm running out of hard drive space. So to bring it back to the original topic, it's awesome we can plug in hard drives now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with the more recent Xbox 360 releases, you know, you basically had to go out and, you know, go and get an additional flash drive just to play some of the newer releases.
Yeah, because like GTA 5 and stuff all require installs, so.
Yeah. Well, GTA 5 was, well, no, never mind, because I did GTA 5 for my PS3, so I didn't have to worry about that. But yeah, with the Xbox 360, you definitely had to do that.
Yeah. Cool.
So, all right, so up next, Breath of Fire 6, it looks like.
Yeah, this is kind of a weird situation. Another example of a long-running franchise being seen again for the first time in years as a mobile game.
As we say here on the show many times, the 90s never ended. We are still very much inside of them.
Yeah.
We can hope.
Yeah, this isn't the year.
It is not. I think it's not 2015. It's the year 1995.
I'm still wearing my plaid shirt right now.
So if you go to the Breath of Fire 6 website, it'll redirect you to a link that implies a PC version. And not only does that kind of naturally restore interest in the game, but if you look into it some more, it actually looks pretty damn good from the trailer that they got out there, from all the info that's out there. This is a game that's suddenly becoming relevant to a lot of us, if this holds up to what it looks to be. Hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, at the very least, it has to be better than Dragon Quarter.
Oh, yeah.
So, it's not a huge news item necessarily yet, but it's definitely something to keep an eye on as the game, as its development winds down and it really starts to take shape and we start seeing exactly, you know, how we're going to end up playing this game if we do at all. Still mm-hmm. no word of a Western release, of course, but it's coming together. And for people who enjoy the series, it, you know, the website is definitely worth a look. There's a trailer there. There's a good amount of information. It's all in Japanese, but there's some stuff that you can
kind of insinuate.
Yeah.
I just find it fascinating that the PC is really becoming, you know, the 1990s equivalent of a PS1. Well, the today's equivalent of a PS1.
Yeah.
It's got pretty much everything.
Well, the thing is, all those, you know, developers who grew up playing, you know, PS1 and PS2, when they gravitated over to game design, they found that the console, the console market wasn't as friendly to their creative vision as the PC market was. And ultimately they found, you know, going through the PC would just be easier.
Yeah, this is true.
Less hoops to jump through.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Not as much corporate red tape bullshit, really.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, it's interesting to see this kind of stuff float back around. But I, again, like, you know, to we were talking about it earlier, but so much of when you had that transition from the PS1 and the PS2 into the PS360 generation, you know, the middle part of that market just disappeared. Everything was AAA or it was a downloadable title that was $10 or $15. So, you know, those B-tier games that were $35 or $40, all those disappeared. And, you know, you've sort of seen like this arms race with the industry where it's, you know, every game has to be $60. It has to be a AAA experience. And so and that has hurt developers like Capcom, particularly a lot of Japanese developers that were so dominant in the 16-bit mm-hmm. and 32-bit era and all those guys just haven't done much. And so it's interesting to see them kind of pull this stuff back out because I think we need it in the industry. You know, there's a lot of homogenization right now, so I'm really happy to see this stuff.
There's a large segment of the modern gaming world that's gotten really burned out with the whole AAA side of the gaming industry. And, you know, the problem with the AAA game industry is that it's just like Hollywood. You know, they've got a formula, and the big thing about AAA is you put all this money into it and you exploit the hell out of that formula as much as you possibly can.
Yeah,
well, and I think we're sort of seeing it come to its head because, like, I've been playing the latest Assassin's Creed, and I'm actually a really big Assassin's Creed fan, but the way that they dealt with that, the way they dealt with Far Cry 4, all these other things, like, it's so much now where it feels like a lot of these games in the AAA space are doing what I would call checklist gaming, where it's like, okay, do you have an open world? Okay, check. Do you have random collectibles that don't mean shit and don't add anything to the game? Check. You know, and so, like, Ubisoft, I think, particularly almost has a house style with their games because they all operate very similarly despite whatever their
whatever the setting is.
Yeah, whatever the setting is. So, and I think these developers particularly are starting to realize that as much as they want to make games like this, there is simply the audience that they want to reach is not big enough. Because for even with games like Assassin's Creed that are that, you know, always do well, same with Call of Duties, there are so many others where you see people go for that AAA money and it just tanks them. Look at what happened with Darksiders 2. You know, game was so bloated. Like, if they had cut 15 hours out of it, I know the guy that did the combat engine on that game. You know, and but they were just chasing after, like, we have to add this, we have to add this, we have to add this. And, you know, you create this sort of unwieldy thing. And I think people are kind of tired of that. And I think that's why you see the indie scene so much is so focused. Like, we were talking about Axiom Verge. Yeah. It's a very singular style game. It's, this is Metroid. just a little different.
Yeah.
And you're returning to those kinds of experiences. And take a look at something like the Breath of Fire games. Those 90s JRPGs didn't have the sort of sprawl that we see now.
Hmm.
And so I think even going back to that, even revisiting it and trying to update it is definitely a good thing. Because what? I don't want another Final Fantasy 13.
Nah. Well, the thing was about the old JRPGs is that, you know, the thing that they were really good at is making the most of the limited technology and resources that they had. Like, just look at Final Fantasy VI. You know, that whole thing, you know, especially originally when the Super Nintendo, who here can honestly say that before Final Fantasy VI, they had ever had a little tear up in their eye from hearing a bit of chiptune music?
Yeah,
because that opera scene in Final Fantasy, the first time I heard that opera scene in Final Fantasy VI, it actually got me to tear up a little bit.
Mm.
And see, that's what those old JRPGs were really good at. They had limited resources, but they were just fantastic at just exploiting the heck out of them.
Hmm.
Well, yeah, and there's something to be said about a lot of great art is made with limitation, you know. And these games where there's this, you know, they pretty much have unlimited budgets, they have unlimited resources. They can have people working on textures for a rock for 13 weeks. That's not really going to produce something great. And I think the industry has is kind of sucking itself back in to create some more of those leaner experiences. And I think it's going to be good for everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely agree with that.
Just remember, we had a very successful gaming industry that lasted for a long time before AAA became a thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I'm convinced that we were heading...
All those old JRPGs from the 16-bit days were so stylistically beloved as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I would ultimately say we are heading headlong into eventually the AAA gaming bubble bursting, but I think ultimately better for it. Yeah.
You saw with Assassin's Creed this past Christmas. Same thing with Halo and everything, where they just had to put those games out because they had to make the money. I think that's the beginning of the bubble bursting, because you've seen like a lot of gamers will just kind of sit there and take it, right? They weren't really doing that for these. I've never seen companies flip back so quick and go, "We fucked up." Not like this.
And I think ultimately the crowning achievement of Suck in that would really be shared between Assassin's Creed Unity and Order 1886.
Yeah.
Yeah. Order 1886 is an interesting case in that there's nothing inherently really wrong with the game.
No, it's not. It's not that the game is, you know, it sets out to do what it does and it does it really well, but the problem is that it came out, in my view, too late in the PS4's life cycle. If it had been like a debut title, it would have been much better received.
Yeah.
You know, because ultimately, Order 1886 was mostly more of a graphics demo with occasional gameplay.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah, lo and behold, that's what it ended up being.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway, on to something else. we got to make sure, hope this thing doesn't end up going too much over an hour.
In keeping with the theme that the 90s never ended, Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 5 was leaked by a caterer, of all things.
Yep.
So extreme that the caterer leaked it.
Yeah.
Just took a picture of his own handiwork, a massive dinner being served up in a half pipe, and the photographer also caught a glimpse of what might be at least the logo.
I just hope that this game doesn't, you know, require a weird peripheral like those last couple of Tony Hawk games, because I think
Tony Hawk Ride.
Ride.
And, yeah,
that was not a good game.
No. I would love for them to get back to the Tony Hawk 2 and 3 style. I mean, Tony Hawk was one of those games that kind of fell into that problem with the whole AAA gaming space. I mean, they farmed it out. They had their formula, and then they ran it into the ground. And it's a shame because, like, Pat and I go way back. And I remember talking to him about Tony Hawk 2 on the Dreamcast. And just when we did all that, when we were playing PSO together, and just that game took up so much of my time with me and my roommates. And it's one of those things where, at least for me, the big part of it that was so much fun is that you could just immediately jump into it. One of the problems that I have with gaming today is that I can't start anything and play it for 30 minutes. The intro takes an hour, you know, and then yeah. I get into the tutorial, and then I kind of miss the days of with something like Tony Hawk, where it's like, here's this thing, I can play around it, and I can kind of do what I want, and if I fail or if I, you know, whatever, I can be successful, but I'm still playing it, you know, I can compare it to my friends, I can do that. So, and I think they kind of lost that in the last few games, you know, particularly trying to get in peripherals and all that other nonsense. But if they can get it into a return to form, man, that would be glorious. I just hope it sells.
Yeah.
The thing about the Tony Hawk game, Pro Skater games, that really made them fun was that they were only semi-realistic. You know, you're
grinding power lines and not breaking your neck.
You could grind across the blades of a helicopter, and the helicopter would start up and crash through the roof of that airbase.
Somehow,
it was so creative, some of the stuff that they did with those levels.
And but the thing is, considering the graphic prowess we have now, you can just imagine the type of crazy stuff they could come up with for, you know, level design as far as this generation is concerned. If they can keep that sort of playfulness and, you know, sense of holy shit, this is extreme balls that they did with the last few games, they can really make something special here.
Yeah,
it would be great to see, because, you know, and hopefully they won't go try to, like, do some hardcore extreme, you know, nonsense the way that that SSX reboot tried to be. Like, they took everything that was joyful from SSX and stripped it out. And, you know, that you kind of saw them do that with the Tony Hawk games later in their life. So hopefully they don't go that route. It'll be really interesting.
Yeah.
See, I'm kind of the outlier on the whole Tony Hawk thing, because it seemed like the more over the top and unrealistic they got, the more they lost me. So I don't know if that just
it was just a fine line, really.
Maybe it comes from my interest in watching competitive skateboarding, you know, even before Tony Hawk's Pro Skater came along. But it just seemed like the more over the top they got, I had a much harder time getting into it.
I think 4 is pretty much where it started to go south for me.
Yeah, 3 you could start to see what they did, but it was still cool. And then they, 4 was just, 4 went, you know, ugh.
Yeah. And then they had, like, those weird, that weird trick mechanic with Project 8, where slow everything down and start flipping the board around.
Yeah, like bullet time for a skateboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was not good.
No.
Well, hopefully we'll see more of this at E3.
I would not be surprised if we saw an announcement before, given that, you know, apparently they're holding events, at least closed-door events about it. I would expect an imminent announcement.
Yeah,
it's I really hope – just same thing with the Breath of Fire stuff. I hope – bringing back something, you know, older like this, they can do it justice, because I'd buy 2 copies for no reason.
And the best way they can do that is to make sure that they've got people on the development team who actually grew up with this franchise and knows how to appreciate it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, don't have them dangling off strings of talking heads who are just going to dick with the process.
Because
that's what happened to Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah.
We've talked all about that on the show, but...
There's a reason that, what's his name? Yu Suzuki?
Yuji Naka.
Yuji Naka bailed halfway through that game's development.
The minute they had Sonic get a doppelganger with a gun, that was it.
It's like,
even my son, who's a huge Sonic fan, is like, "Dad, what is this?"
Yeah, what happened?
And wasn't he supposed to die in Sonic Adventures 2 anyway?
I don't know. Sonic is one of those series that I just stopped paying attention to because.
Yeah, we've talked about Sonic before, and we've basically said over and over again, if Sega really wants to bring this franchise back in a big way, you know, there's a comic book continuity that we've had going on here in the U.S. for 20 years. They've got a ready-made franchise they could work with right here, and they will get a million seller guaranteed.
Although now, yeah, given the current situation at Sega, I don't think that's ever going to have the chance to happen.
Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to see any of that, and that means I'll never see another Skies of Arcadia, which is depressing. So this is really just the old man podcast now.
It pretty much is.
Pretty much.
Yeah. All you youngsters with your newfangled DLC.
Back in our day, we had expansion packs, which you had to go to the store to buy. And we liked it.
Walked up the hill, uphill both ways in the snow, no shoes. I had to ride a bike for 3.5 hours to generate the power just to run my Genesis for 25 minutes.
And we liked it.
Yeah. Why do you think all the games were so short back then? You had to play a 40-hour RPG, you'd lose 20 pounds just riding that bike.
Oh, shit.
On to something a little more positive.
Yeah, SNK, amidst some weird Chinese buyout rumors, has launched a King of Fighters triple pack on Steam that pretty much represents... I would say the best that the series has to offer. It was on sale when they launched it, but now it's back up to $34.99, which looks like it's going to be the steady price for it.
Which is still a good price for the games you get in here.
I mean, it's King of Fighters 98 Ultimate Match, King of Fighters 2002 Unlimited Match, and King of Fighters 13.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that's really all the KOF you should ever need.
Yeah.
I remember when the first King of Fighters game came out, and I was just so, I thought it was so cool to see these different characters from these different franchises all fighting in the same game. You know, this was the days before we had X-Men versus Street Fighter.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Well, X-Men versus Street Fighter was still like 2 years off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was the idea of seeing, like, the characters, like, wait a minute, you mean I got the characters from Fatal Fury and Art of Fighting? Awesome.
And then just a bunch of randoms that...
Originals.
Right. Many of which eventually became...
Their own fight.
Many of which actually became popular in their own right.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So, I think some of those games, those characters actually did come from other...
Yeah, Ikari Warriors, Psycho Soldier, that's what I was talking about. Mm.
Yeah,
real randoms SNK just plucked from their franchise catalog, and they made it work.
Yeah, I remember, Pat, I remember back in the day you telling me, like, you gotta get into this stuff. It's, you know. And, I remember, you know, back when you could get the, you could actually go to an arcade, since we're the old people podcast. Sam Arcade played Mortal Kombat 2 and also ended up getting King of the Fighters and all that stuff, and I just think it's so awesome that we even get re-releases like this. Which, you know, I think we're sort of at a point, especially for, you know, where we're getting to where gamers are going to basically be multi-generational now. I think this kind of stuff is really important, particularly for preservation. So even having something available that's workable is really this is the foundation of so many things. And just having that around, especially when it's very possible, you know, these companies, SNK, Sega and stuff, they may not exist in 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
It's great because, you know, video games are no longer just disposable entertainment. They're up there with books and movies now. There are people who are actively trying to preserve them and
we'll be keep them going.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little later.
Look, just for the record, we want to make it clear, even though this is the old man podcast, we don't hate the new generation. We still love the games that come out today.
Yeah.
But
even to that point, I mean, with the with the differentiation from the PS 360 generation and there being no backwards compatibility, it's sort of like, you know, the stuff that we dealt with when we were kids, when we were teenagers. You know, you had your Nintendo, and then if you decided to trade it in, you couldn't touch that stuff anymore. So, especially with these, with having the online component in a lot of these games, we also could end up at a point where some of the stuff's not playable anymore because the components required for it are not there. So, that's going to be another thing that's going to be interesting seeing going forward. Yeah. So that's why I'm happy we have stuff like this getting re-released, because at least on the PC, it's perpetual. If you upgrade your PC, you're not going to just stop being able to play these games. Right. There are workarounds.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can figure out how to use DOSBox, you've got a whole generation of old PC gaming at your fingertips. Right. So,
and if you can't, you can just go to archive.org and they've sorted it out for you.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Nice little plug for the audio, the site that hosts our audio versions of the podcast.
Yeah.
I forgot what I was going to say, but
well, might as well move on to extra drives.
Yeah. Where'd your kids stop skateboarding on the sidewalks?
So yeah, apparently Hexa Drive has been on the Final Fantasy 15 development team since just before it became Final Fantasy 15. This is kind of interesting, just given that this is a studio best known for HD remakes and things like that. They were actually tapped to do the Final Fantasy Type-0 HD edition. Now that we know the timeline here, while they were working on Final Fantasy 15. And so, but they've got a long history of doing HD remasters, and they've also got a good history of working with Square Enix. They were the team behind, or at least part of the team behind, The Third Birthday and, you know, a couple of those. And so, it's just kind of interesting watching this, because it seems like they might, Hexadrive might be to Hajime Tabata what Dimps is quickly becoming to Yoshinori Ono. And so it's more hands on deck for an important studio.
Yeah.
Not really a whole lot of analysis to go into on that. It's just, I just thought that was noteworthy.
Well, there is one thing I could point out in that. So they've been on the Final Fantasy 15 project for, you know, a little over a year now. So I'm assuming they would have
closer to two.
Yeah, I'm assuming they would have had a hand in the demo that came out. So
yeah.
If the demo that came out is indicative of what the game is after they've been working on it, how bad was it before?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Square seems to be in a really interesting upheaval internally. They were roundly rejected this generation for the most part with everything that they did, from the Final Fantasy 13 games to the original Final Fantasy 14 launch. You know,
pretty much their only real success. Pretty much their only real successes have been the stuff that, you know, they only produced, like, you know, the Tomb Raider reboot and Deus Ex Human Revolution
and all that. Well, and even then, to you know, you take it a step further, they were shocked and how well Bravely Default did. They're definitely a company that I think got away from what they did best. And so on one hand, it does make me wonder, like, you know, to what Phil was saying, how bad was it? But at the same time, maybe, like, especially with the complete cock-up that was Final Fantasy 14, you know, they really seem to – I think Final Fantasy 13 and the launch of Final Fantasy 14 really damaged their brand overall. I'm sure you guys can remember back in the day in the 16-bit era, the 32-bit era, anything Square produced was gold.
And it didn't even have to be like Final Fantasy stuff. It was like really obscure stuff like Einhander or Bushido Blade or Brave Fencer Musashi. Yeah,
they were Saga able to Frontier. Do that. Their name, they were able to coast by on their name. And but their name also meant that at least, you know, in the same way that Nintendo's name still means something to a lot of people. You know, if you purchase a Nintendo game, at least the fundamentals of it at its core is going to be a polished product. And you had the same thing with Square. Really, up until this generation, their output was awful. All the people that really made all their great games left.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have audiences, you know, that came out. They lambasted Final Fantasy 13. They, you know, there was so much mismanagement across the board with them. So I'm happy to see they're at least trying to do something to make sure they don't continuously fail.
Well, there was a changing of the guard over it. I mean, that's why Yoichi Wada is over their cloud gaming arm now, and they've got a new guy in there, Yosuke Matsuda, who is swearing that he's going to rebuild the company around traditional JRPGs. And it's that's the entire reason that happened. And so,
I mean, really, if you want a good idea of just how bad it got, literally the first thing that when the new CEO came in, the first public statement he said is, "We done fucked it up."
Yeah.
Well, not just that, he seemed completely and utterly pissed off that Nintendo got all of that Bravely Default revenue in North America because the company hadn't seen fit to, that they hadn't seen the money in releasing it over here.
Well, and that's really their whole problem in the first place. The Square sort of fell into that same AAA trap that we've seen so many other developers do, where they're like, well, this can't move 5 million copies. It's just not worth putting out. And when you have your business model only revolving around something that needs to sell 5 million copies, you're going to fail.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to fill those holes with something else.
Yeah. Like, look at that. Look at another thing. Tomb Raider, the Tomb Raider reboot, that game sold extremely well. And yet Square Enix still thought of it as a failure because it didn't meet the astronomical. Yeah. It did not meet the astronomical, you know,
expectations.
It just didn't. And of course,
that shows just kind of the frame of mind that they got into. Like, you know, there are so many stories when it came to like how Final Fantasy 13 was created, where you would have people doing rock textures for 8 weeks. Like, people were just making assets to just do it because there wasn't any direction, you know, on the project. So, I mean, they definitely seem to, it's good to see them do that, because I think a lot of companies over the last generation have truly blown their capital with gamers. So to see them make that effort instead of kind of just fade, I think is really important. And hopefully a lot of other Japanese developers, people like Capcom especially, maybe they can pay attention to them and really try and get back to the stuff that made their games work. And not aiming for that Call of Duty money, because not everybody can be Call of Duty. Not everybody can sell that kind of – or push that many units. Yeah. You know, there's a niche.
Call of Duty anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, make no mistake, that Call of Duty bubble is fit to burst pretty soon.
Yeah.
So
we're already seeing it.
Yeah, we're seeing it now, and then, you know, the sales, I think, are down overall. But, you know, that's also catering to a group of people that just buys one or two games a year. Those people were never going to be their customers in the first place. So chasing those people was a folly in the first place. That's why it's still funny to this day reading about how they were like, we can't believe Bravely Default did so well. Well, you guys haven't been putting out anything like that to attract people that would want a game like that.
Yeah. And almost, you know, a decade, really.
Yeah, and they're still doing it. Even the fact that they haven't brought over Dragon Quest VII, when there is, even though it's small, there is a hungry group of consumers in America that wants Dragon Quest stuff. They're still going, well, we can't sell 2 million copies, so it's not worth it. But they also know that Dragon Quest is worth something, so they won't farm it out to a company like Falcom or XSEED to get it done. So, you know, they do seem to be learning, but they still got a ways to go.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is the old man podcast.
This is fun. Sticking with Square Enix for a little while on this show, there's some new trailers out for Dissidia Arcade Edition that we talked about a few weeks ago. It looks fantastic. Mm-hmm. More info's coming in. Team Ninja, the developers this time around, and I think that's a perfect fit.
Mm. So there will be, they are, you know, the thing about Team Ninja, I mean, give all the, you know, love it or hate it, DOA does have a very solid, you know, there is a very solid, very unusually complex fighting system underneath it. So, you know, they know how to make fighting games.
Yeah.
And they're hardware geniuses.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
they're giving it to a group of people that knows how to make something like this. And that's so key. You know, this is one of the things that Team Ninja does. They're not like farming it out to their mobile division and go, hey, make a fighting game. You know, you give this kind of stuff to the people that know how to make it, you're going to be able to produce something awesome. And that game looks bananas.
Yeah.
I love the free idea.
There are three things that Team Ninja knows how to do well. The first one, make really solid over-the-top fighting games. Two, make really solid over-the-top action-adventure games. Three, tits and ass. So, you know.
Knows how to do that. However, there's one thing Team Ninja doesn't know how to do, and that's make a Metroid game.
Yeah.
We
pretend that doesn't exist. It never happened. Other M, what is that? What is this you speak of?
No, we have Axiom Verge now. We don't have to talk about it.
Yeah.
Let's go to our happy place.
Yeah.
It's a bad memory. It never happened.
But yeah. Other information on that, the new arcade hardware is PS4 based, so a console port will be really easy to pull off. 50 characters, not including DLC or time release stuff, apparently. And the one that I found most interesting here is that Ramza is confirmed from Final Fantasy Tactics. A character that we really haven't seen much of since then. And if the early designs are any indication, we are going to see what happens when Tetsuya Nomura gets hold of him.
Zippers.
Here's the thing. Tetsuya Nomura, his character design can go 50-50. It can be either really ridiculous or it can be really cool. Like, look at what he did when he did Batman and Catwoman for the collectibles market.
Oh, the Star Wars.
His Batman was badass. Yeah, the Batman was badass too. The Catwoman, on the other hand, little bit.
Uh-oh.
Little too bombastic.
Yeah.
Well, you know, people can say what they want about Nomura, but the guy is iconic in that sense. He just tends to go overboard, I think, these days.
Yeah.
But who knows? Maybe with Team Ninja do it, Ramza will have tits.
Oh, maybe.
And zippers.
Yeah. And belts. Lots and lots of belts.
Belts around.
Maybe
the
his whole. Maybe the whole outfit will be nothing but belts. I mean, that's what he did to Lulu in Final Fantasy X. So.
Yeah, bad mental image. Some more Square Enix news, or possibly.
Yeah, well, they did just announce a new Deus Ex game.
Mm-hmm. That pretty much blew up the internet when it happened.
I'm so hyped for that. I don't know if you guys played Human Revolution, but Revolution was one of those games that snuck up on me, and I still think to this day it's one of the most atmosphere. It's limited in a lot of ways, but it's one of the most atmospheric games that I have ever played. And it was just cool being able to run around in those worlds. And like, I'm a guy that really likes. I really enjoy trying to break things or try to find ways to be, like, superly powerful. Like when I played Oblivion. On consoles, I ended up finding a place where I could sneak, and I just held the controller with a rubber band to the right. So I had a red guard in full, like, heavy armor who was able to jump, like, to the top of houses and sneak up on people like a ninja. So Deus Ex, the Human Revolution, really, like, scratched that itch for me. It was really interesting to be able to approach this stuff so many different ways. And
Really, though, the only flaw that Human Revolution had were the boss fights, which, in fairness to the developer, that was something they farmed out to another company.
Yeah, those are the only things that didn't work. And you know, of course, they fixed that with the Definitive Edition or whatever it was called.
Yeah.
Director's cut.
That and also in pieces, in some parts, the graphics did look a little bit more dated than they needed to be. But, you know, other than that, it was a really solid game.
It's a really solid game. So I hope they can keep the spirit of it and not really try to go nuts and hope it'll be like an 8 million seller or something like that. And then destroy the franchise because it doesn't end up being that way. But I'm really, I'm really looking forward to that game. Because it is one of those properties that, you know, Metal Gear has gotten so overwhelmingly just weird. So to have
has always been overly weird.
Not like it is now. And you know, we don't have any real proper, like, you know, sneaking games. Tenchu doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. So speaking of the 90s and going back to the old man podcast. But
we did have Dishonored.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, Dishonored was fantastic.
Which was a good game.
But yeah, you don't really have a lot of those games where you kind of have that free form, kind of get into the world and approach it how you want to. So I really just
They tried to do that with the newer Thief, and that one just blew up in their face.
Yeah, Thief was terrible. Terrible.
I don't know. I didn't mind it.
Shun the non-believer. Shun. Shun.
Turn off all the assists.
Life day. Renew.
Okay,
999 Chinese earthquake. Sorry, I short circuited there.
Okay. So anyway, the Japanese Square Enix site has a teaser site up that seems to be hinting at a new Star Ocean. Everyone's pretty much operating on the assumption that that's what it's going to be at this point.
Yeah.
I can definitely see why.
I think the last Star Ocean game that
give a fuck because of the last Star Ocean.
Yeah, the last Star Ocean, that was the like the Uber prequel, wasn't it? The Star Ocean: The Last Hope.
Yeah, it just did so many things wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, again, that was right around the time when you know, Square Enix was probably at their worst.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you really got to think how bad it is when the one game that was, like, really good, that was of any worth at that period, was Infinite Undiscovery, which was...
Right.
Profoundly stupid, but actually had a solid gameplay underneath it, so it actually managed to survive a bit.
Yeah, well, but you know, same thing. Going back to the, seems to be like the theme. You know, maybe this would be one of those things where they've mined it out so much they realized they did all of these things that did not work. So now maybe they're trying to, you know, really go to something that does.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, hopefully they just don't, possibly, you know, repeat the same mistakes and make a shitty serialized linear role playing game that nobody wants to play.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, if the new CEO is any sign, I think maybe Square Enix has started to learn their lessons, and hopefully they'll be able to avoid those mistakes in the future.
Yeah.
Well, look at what's happened since he stepped in. We've got all these really super traditional Final Fantasy games going to mobile, and I'm sure that Final Fantasy 16 will have a real sense of coming home to it for people on the console side. We got two new Saga games announced almost right away.
We got Kingdom Hearts 3 in development.
Kingdom Hearts 3 happened on Yoichi Wada's watch. That and Final Fantasy 15 are going to kind of
be the last vestiges of that
era. But everything that's happened since since Yosuke Matsuda stepped in has been, I don't want to say a throwback, because that would imply that it's not a good place to go moving forward, but it's definitely indicative of Square Enix at their best, at their most successful, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes of it.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me because Square Enix is in a kind of an unusual situation where they've got this, you know, massive back catalog of IP that they can draw from. They've got, you know, Final Fantasy, they've got Dragon Quest, they've got all that. But they've also got some modern stuff that people like Deus Ex, they've got Thief, they've got, well, hopefully they'll actually fix Thief according to you guys. I didn't find a problem with it. Anyway, so they're in a position where they can do the smaller titles, get the audience that they get from that, but also still have the big hits.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the thing. Hopefully that is something that they really do target, because that was how they used to operate in the past. And then for whatever reason in the first HD generation, they seem to have just kind of cast that off. And to be fair, a lot of other developers did that as well. But there aren't a lot of developers that have the catalog and have the IP that Square has. Konami, maybe. But and look at what happened with them. So,
Kojima
up they're and not left be doing them, that anytime
so.
Soon.
Yeah, so I think this is definitely a good thing, really, for the industry as a whole, particularly the Japanese industry, because, you know, I think you've really seen them suffer, you know, this past generation. Simply because they were trying to you know, chase that Western dollar, not realizing the stuff that made them successful in the first place worked, and they just should have just kept on with that rather than trying to chase that Call of Duty money.
And Matsuda has said exactly that himself. He was expressing his frustration about the company chasing after the so-called global audience that isn't really there, and when something like Bravely Default can come out and just be a really strong seller for him.
Yeah.
And the fact that he thinks of Bravely Default as a strong seller makes me really happy about where the company is going.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because what that really, what did that, that only pushed, was it half a million?
Yeah, it was no million seller by any stretch, but it was a good, it sold respectable numbers.
And, yeah. Well, and then I also think, too, like, you know, these mobile titles, you know, the 3DS stuff, I mean, the budgets are obviously considerably smaller.
Yeah.
So there is a higher margin for them to make that money. And, you know, frankly, I would be okay with a lot of those style games remaining on handhelds. I think they would give handhelds, you know, a continued reason to exist in the face of things like iPhones and iPads, and still provide that kind of dedicated experience, but also allow companies like Square to have smaller hits and still have it be something that's profitable for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope this is definitely a trend that'll continue. And God, I want Dragon Quest VII on DS, on the 3DS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robotrek.
Now, here's what I want to know: is Grandia Square Enix property these days, or were they just the publisher for Extreme and 3?
Oh, I don't know.
I think they were just public.
No idea
at that point. I don't know what the right situation is for Grandia at this point. But
yeah, it's kind of weird because the situation at Game Arts, the series creator Takeshi Miyagi passed away a few years ago, and it wasn't looking like a new Grandia was imminent even then. What I was thinking was if it were Square Enix property, then maybe there might still be some hope. But
right.
I don't know. It's a situation that I'm not altogether clear on.
Well,
I'm probably going to have to look into it some more, but that's something that I'd really like to see them include as part of their resurgence, if at all possible.
Yeah. Well, if we're looking to be the, you know, the RPG company again, might make that sense for them to do the legwork and get those rights.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That has a lot of potential. You know, as long as they don't really mess with the core gameplay too much and just sort of, you know, do what made Final Fantasy so successful all those years. And that's kind of what Game Arts was doing with Grandia, was just find new ways to implement the core system and let it feel distinct while still having that familiarity and that, I guess, intuitiveness that it has for people coming back from past games.
Yeah.
So.
Wait and bated breath.
That's just something I was thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah. So, citing toxicity concerns, Splatoon is not going to have voice chat.
And to be honest, I am completely okay with that, to be honest.
You know, Pat and I had talked about this actually at length before the podcast, but not to keep kind of bringing it back, like, I am a parent, you know, and the toxicity, I play MMOs, I play a lot of online games, the toxicity that exists online, I really think is really a detriment to gaming. I think, you know, I don't want to tie it into so many things, but, you know, I feel like so much of the toxicity that exists in gaming is sort of right underneath the skin. I'm deeply involved with the fighting game community. We had an incident a few years ago where basically one guy tried to speak for the whole community and said that misogyny was just a part of the community. It was something that was intertwined in the DNA of it. And he had the nerve to say that.
2013, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I don't want to say the guy's name because he's an asshole, but.
Yeah, it was. If I remember the story correctly, there was these two teams were playing. I think it was Street Fighter.
Yeah, Capcom was doing a reality show, and there was a girl on there, and one of the guys that was on the show basically kind of went out of his way to try and intimidate her. He would smell her and literally sniff her and tell her he had a pretty dress for her to put on, and just basically degraded her. In a really, really disgusting – I mean, of course, degrading somebody in general is disgusting, but he really kind of took it like three steps further. And
ultimately it got so bad that she basically just walked away.
Yeah, yeah.
Like she put down her controller and just left. Yep.
Yeah, and so she actually didn't come to the event that I helped with, which is called Final Round here in Atlanta. And we messed up because we didn't realize this was going on. Because we would have extended a handout to her and said, no, look, you can come here. It's safe. You know, because with Final Round, it's really a family thing. But we've done it for 18 years now. And this all started when we were all single. And now pretty much everybody involved with the organization is married, has kids. People bring their families out, you know, for the weekend. So that toxicity is almost in opposition to the kind of community that exists with gaming now. And anything online, especially, you know, you get on Xbox, you get called a faggot, you get called a nigger, like all these awful things. And so I can understand why they did it. But at the same time, I feel like this is one of those ways that Nintendo is simply taking away choice from people. Because when I get online with my PlayStation 4, I immediately start my own party. Then I don't have to listen to anyone else. But my friends can join my party and we can still talk. If we're going to be doing any form of a competitive shooter, I think you should at least be able to have your own party. And then you choose who you're going to talk with. And that's the barrier from the toxicity, not just taking away the option entirely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I totally
agree with that.
And like I said, I do worry about that because I am a parent. Because I don't want – I'm really careful. Like my son – he has access to my Xbox Live account, but I have the mic. I have the headset.
Yeah.
He doesn't get the headset unless I know who he's playing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. That's actually really smart, I got to admit.
Because otherwise he's going to end up and I have the chat stuff turned off. So, you know, he can't accidentally end up in some place and get called a shit cock faggot, whatever, you know, that you hear online.
Yeah.
But I just taking away the option to even I could get it. If you just don't want to hear the random people in the game, I'm totally cool with that. Like I play Grand Theft Auto online a lot. And if you aren't in your own party on the PlayStation 4, you will hear people screaming at the top of their lungs, playing music, doing all this stuff that's just really there to grief the people playing. But I have the option. Mm-hmm. If I want to listen to that, I can. If I don't, I just join my own party. And if I want to play with my friends, I invite them. Taking away the option is stupid.
Yeah.
Especially in a game where, you know, Nintendo is a company that thrives. Their games thrive on social interaction. Pokemon, Mario Kart, all that stuff is built around the ability to talk and play with someone. And we are firmly entrenched in the online generation now. And having it where you can't even talk to somebody that you choose to talk to is such a huge step back. And I get the idea of toxicity and wanting, especially because their games are played by kids. But taking away the option entirely is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I can agree with that. But speaking of earlier, you were talking about how toxicity. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that it was funny that you mentioned Mario Kart because the development team, I forget who it was, one of the lead producers, though, said they want Splatoon to do with action shooters what Mario Kart did for racing games. And so they're drawing a direct comparison there that kind of puts a
right
puts an interesting light on this choice, I think.
Yeah.
Well, but see, but hopefully the difference between those two, though, is that Mario Kart at its core is a is you versus seven or eight other people.
Yeah.
Splatoon, mm-hmm. at least from everything that I've seen, is 100% a team-based shooter. And there's a very big difference. And I know you guys all know this. There's a very big difference from playing with a bunch of randoms and then playing with a coordinated group.
Yeah.
When you play games like that, whatever, forget their what they look like and everything else, playing with a dedicated group of people that are on the same page and that you're coordinating with is one of the most awesome experiences in gaming. And Splatoon is automatically going to be downgraded from that just because you don't have the option. Yeah. And I think that's really stupid, particularly for a new IP for Nintendo, where they could really kind of break away from the attitude I think that a lot of people have about Nintendo, about how they're so conservative and all of these things. That game could truly, because it looks awesome. Like, my wife wants
to play. Yeah, it really does.
My kid wants to play it. This is something we could play together. This is something we could play with some of our friends that also have kids. But what am I going to do? Stick a speakerphone in the middle of my living room and hope that's the way that we can talk and go, hey, oh, we're getting attacked on the east side or whatever. No, automatically, the ability to come together and play with people and really, really have a good time is stunted just because of this choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe hopefully Nintendo will maybe rethink it, and then maybe they'll say, okay, we'll have voice chat, but it can only be done
on your friends list.
Yeah.
On your friends list or on your own team.
Which
or
would
whatever.
Yeah, that would make much more sense.
Hmm.
But you were saying earlier about how there seemed to be this toxicity just under the surface of the gaming community. You really only need to look at the whole clusterfuck that was Gamergate.
Right, yeah.
To see that. And we've talked about it on this show before. I've said before, it didn't have to be Gamergate. It could have been something else. But there's always been this sort of toxic underbelly to the gaming community that's just been festering for the better part of a decade.
It's definitely there, and it grows from the idea of gaming needing to be some sort of exclusive thing that defines that person in whatever way that they need to be defined. And you know, I used to be one of those people when I was a teenager. It was like, you know, I'm a hardcore gamer, and these people that do this one type of gaming or whatever, they're stupid and they suck or whatever. And you can even see it. I mean, we've sort of done it on this show where we talked about like the Call of Duty players. They are just a different group of gamers, but they're still gamers. People like my wife.
Yeah.
My wife plays online games. My wife games a lot on her iPad.
Mm-hmm.
Her doing that doesn't make her any less of a gamer, but what these droves of troglodytes have done is that they've created this gigantic barrier where they seem to feel that the type of games that they want to play is threatened by the fact that there are other people that might enjoy things that they don't. And you do see that bubble out in games where there are voice functions and people can talk and people can say whatever they want without retribution. I mean, people would not act that way, and Pat knows this because Pat's gone to fighting game tournaments. You could see people talk all kinds of shit online, and then when they see you in person, it's like, oh my God, I was just screwing around, blah, 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 blah. With that element taken away from it, that's the other reason why that toxicity almost kind of just festers and grows. And it's a shame because I really think that as long as we have that undercurrent there, to the point where you have people like Nintendo going, you know what, we just don't even want any part of this and we're going to blank it out, we're not really addressing the problem as to why this stuff happens. These aren't going to be solutions.
Yeah. The thing is, you got to remember, though, is that this type of sort of elitism isn't something that's new to, you know, quote unquote geek hobbies. You can go back and look at like bunch of like old magazines and comic books especially from like the 70s and 80s, and look in their letters column, and you can see the exact same kind of behavior and rhetoric.
Well, and then, but that also speaks to the idea of, okay, so we've been talking, you know, this podcast about sales and getting back to things that work and stuff like that. With the Wii generation, and especially with tablets and all these other things, people that bought into stuff like the Wii, people that aren't going to be getting a 3DS but will play games on like an iPad or something like that, those are people that can be catered to, and those are people that companies like Square and everybody else can cater to. The idea that for so much of this time, I think people like that haven't been catered to, and now they're finally getting catered to. And I think that was a big part of the reason why you saw the reaction with Gamersgate, because frankly, young white males felt like all of a sudden they weren't going to be the focal point anymore. I play MMOs. I see all kinds of crazy shit online. And I think it's great that we're kind of getting to a point where somebody can make, you know, I'm going to say something like, I'm going to rape this girl, and they're shamed for it. I think that's fantastic. I also don't think that the way to handle toxicity is simply to remove the means for communication. I think that's ridiculous. I think it should be choice-based, because that's the other thing. You can choose who you associate with, right?
Right.
You have that choice. That choice is in your hands. And so taking that choice away, I think does Nintendo a disservice, and it does the community a disservice, particularly for the situation that Nintendo's in. They need to sell as much as possible, and they need to appeal to as many people as possible. And you know what? Maybe that's also why they're doing this. Maybe they just feel like this could be a game that people that don't want to deal with that toxicity can do. But again, taking away that choice rather than giving it, I think is a mistake.
Yeah.
Agreed. And you hope this does work, because not only, you know, this is the first new Nintendo IP we've had in a few years, but it's also one that's got an incredible amount of potential. So
it looks so cool. It looks so cool. It's going to be one of those games that I will actually pick up when it first comes out, because it is something that I can do with my family. And you know, that's one of the things that Nintendo is also really strong with. I don't feel at all uncomfortable leaving my son with any sort of Nintendo game. Whereas, you know, I think that certainly doesn't exist anywhere else. So again, I can understand their reason for that decision. But just taking the option away is just really dumb.
It's the wrong way to handle it.
Exactly. Yeah. There are better ways. We do have parental controls. We do have parents that can go, you know what, I'm not going to give you this mic. You know? Well, maybe that is part of the problem. Maybe it's because a bunch of these parents aren't, you know, patrolling their 12-year-olds who are the ones that get online and call people really, really bad names.
Yeah.
That's a different story.
I think we can go on to our final story for the cast.
And we actually have Lee to thank for this one, because it got under my radar. And Phil, I think it was news to you when I sent it to you as well.
Yeah, Lee posted it, and then I think pretty much everybody else picked up on it a couple of days later. So, you know, it's become a pretty big story where ESA representative is saying that preserving old games should be illegal.
Yeah. Well, and I looked into this a lot when I first saw it, and so, you know, to sort of circle back to what we were talking about, with the King of the Fighters stuff and really kind of having this stuff available, you know, in perpetuity, this works completely against that. And what I found so bothersome when I read what they were doing was the language surrounding it is so broad, and I almost feel like it's indicative of kind of where we are currently in America, where there's so much legislation floating around that uses these really broad terms for how to enforce the law, and we see this type of language happening in so many legal matters, and it's trickling into something like this. And what bugs me about it is, I am all for archiving games, and I think that there's a large group of gamers that are the same way. But if you guys actually look into this provision, what it looks like is basically this provision exists only for one reason, and that is solely because the people that are involved with the creation of these products want to make money on them no matter what. And so that means that even if somebody modified it down the line so it was still playable, they seem to still kind of feel that they should be seeing money off it. And I think in the industry that we're in now, that's sort of – it's really kind of a paradox, because you have, you know, these developers and publishers that demonize anyone that gets anything secondhand or emulation or anything else like that. And just to be clear, I'm not saying anyone should steal anything. But this is the same industry that demonizes people for picking up something secondhand and says GameStop is their worst enemy, but they're the same people that turn around and give pre-order bonuses to GameStop. So, you know, this is one of those things where it almost feels like the industry is eating itself, because the particular section that this revolves around is really with copyright law. And the language was basically put in place because these companies, when they're creating this stuff, they're creating a product, and they cannot fathom someone running a server for a game or modifying a game so it will work with Windows 10 when it previously worked with Windows XP and stuff like that. They cannot fathom that someone would do that and then not try to turn around and sell it. And I think that's the core of the problem, and I think that's why you see the language surrounding it. And there are people out there that simply want to preserve this stuff, and they really want to stand in the way of this. And there seems to be a lot of pushback. Like Phil said, there's a lot of people that have kind of that have come back and have been like, you know, this is turning into a hot topic. And I think especially to, you know, same thing, to bring it back, we were talking about mobile games earlier. We were talking about tablets. You know, EA has been a company that has turned off mobile games, where people have put in hundreds of dollars, and then they've been like, you know what, we're not making the kind of money that we want now, so we're turning this off, and you're losing access to this. We need people that can modify this stuff so some of these companies can't screw their paying customers.
Right. You know, so. And here's the thing. This particular bit that they wrote uses really broad language, and just as the same thing they do in government where they use really broad language in legislation, don't think for a second that they do that by accident. That is done completely on purpose so that they can have wiggle room to selectively apply the law. Yeah. And so that if they end up getting found out, can actually have plausible deniability. Right. So don't think for a second that this is unintentional. They know what they're doing, and it's actually kind of sinister, to be honest.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And it matters more now, I think, than ever, because particularly, I mean, we're talking about the old man podcast. We are a group of people that still has Nintendo cartridges. There's nothing stopping me from playing those Nintendo cartridges, but we look at the games that we have today. So many of these games that are out now have MMO style hooks, stuff like Destiny, Grand Theft Auto Online, hell, even, you know, Diablo, stuff like that, where there's that thing to kind of keep you coming back. When this stuff is shut off, these games are not playable anymore. Like,
exactly.
You know, we were, you know, I'm going back through Dragon Quest IX now. Dragon Quest IX has that online component where you could get stuff from the shop. Well, that's the shop. That's shut down now. So technically the game is incomplete. I can't get those items anymore. And I wish there was a server I could connect to so I could.
Yeah. Just remember, folks, if you think we're sort of overhyping the risk here, don't forget we were a hair's breadth away from losing net neutrality here in the U.S. So, you know, don't think we're just trying to scare you. This shit is a serious risk, and you have to make yourself heard.
Yeah, and it's important too, especially because we have so many game companies that show that the minute that they aren't making the money that they think that they should, they will pull the plug on something.
Yep.
And we're getting to the point now where these games, we're not talking about cutting off one thing or another. We're talking about actually making something completely non-functional. And the idea that you can't – the idea that a company can basically turn off a product that you own is fucked up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
– that's why I traded off the crew before I got too personally invested in it. Even though I pretty fundamentally enjoyed it, I just didn't want to sink that much time into a game that, you know, I can't come back to 5, 6, 7 years
down the road. It's funny you mention that, because let me ask you guys this, because I think so much of this also matters based on who is producing the game. If I don't feel, and tell me if you guys agree, like, because right now, like I said, me and my wife are playing Star Wars, The Old Republic online. And, you know, I had it, I played that game at launch, and then I quit because it was not very good. And then we've kind of come back to it, but I'm very leery about really getting attached. And it's sort of like kind of taken me out of the enjoyment of the game, because I feel like at some point the progress that I made will eventually be erased when EA decides this isn't making the money that they want. So these kinds of games, this kind of stuff, for me, it really matters who the company is that's also doing it, because I don't feel that way. I still have a WoW account. I've had a WoW account since that game launched, and I go back to it every once in a while. I always go back when there's a new expansion and everything else like that. I have no fear that Blizzard's going to shut that down. I have no fear. They're still letting me play StarCraft 1, for Christ's sake, for free.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder, you know, at least for you guys, does this kind of stuff also matter, or do you have the concerns that I do based around who the company is? Absolutely. Because that's one of my biggest
concerns. Yeah, I kind of do. Because, I mean, you talked about Star Wars, and remember, that was developed by BioWare, and right now BioWare is owned by EA, and EA is infamous for its nickel and diming bullshit, and on top of that...
And Blizzard is Activision.
Yeah, yeah, Blizzard is Activision.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is, I do think, but I still feel like there's a really distinct difference between the two. You know, I don't think Blizzard has really ever acted in a sinister way, at least to me, towards their player base. They fucked up Diablo 3, but they turned around and they fixed that with a free patch, and they made the game the way that it should have been when it launched.
Yeah.
I know people cry about... when it comes to WoW, some people are really upset that you can sell mounts and stuff through the store. And I know there are people that were upset that you could boost a character to 90, but none of that affects me enjoying the game. Knowing that Blizzard is a company that is fully invested in what they're doing allows me to then be fully invested in what they're doing. Companies like EA, where I'm like, you know, in 2 or 3 years, and maybe it's just also because of the way that I play, I bounce around to a lot of things. So, you know, imagine, you know, to frame it differently, imagine if you played a game and you came back to it a year later, your save game was gone and the game wouldn't start. That's kind of right. What this stuff feels like to me.
Yeah.
And I feel like a company like EA would be quick to do that, and a company like Blizzard wouldn't. And I think, especially going forward, that's really going to change how much time I invest in certain games. And it's going to be solely based on who actually created it. Yeah. And just like to your point, Pat, you said you kind of gave the crew back because you're like, how much do I really want to put into this, knowing what, you know, kind of knowing that this could just basically get turned off in a year?
Yeah.
And just sort of to kind of wrap this up, because we don't want this thing to go on too long, you know. How is this going to affect, you know, GOG? I mean, that's literally like their entire business model.
Yeah.
Well, GOG apparently didn't get the ESA
memo. Yeah, they didn't get the memo. They don't give a shit. But
and see, the thing is, GOG is owned. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say Steam. I was going to say, a big part of the reason people do Steam is because stuff can be updated and it can be patched.
Yeah.
And so what does it mean for GOG? What does it mean for Steam? Because that language being so broad, that matters.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing is, you were talking about, you know, companies that you trusted. CD Projekt is one of those companies I have absolutely no fear about, because, you know, they have actively shown that they are a consumer-focused company, and that they have this strong sort of more ethical base, that there is a certain line we will not cross.
Yeah.
For our consumers, because we respect them as human beings, you know.
I mean, they don't believe.
Remember, God. One of the great. Yeah, they've made. Yeah, one of the things about GOG is it is militantly anti-DRM.
Yeah.
And
yeah, they seem to believe that if they produce a good product, and that there is, and it's there's a, you know, a fair amount is asked for it, that people will come and
yeah.
You know, that is,
if you've played any of the Witcher games, you know they definitely can make a good product.
Yeah. Well, and even then, remember with Witcher 2, like when they were finally bringing out the console edition, there were so many updates that they were in it, and they were just like, all right, PC gamers, here you go. Here's all the updates for the console. Here you go. Boom.
Just gave it to them for free.
Just gave it to them. Yeah. And that stuff, I think especially going forward, that stuff really, I think it matters more than probably any other time in gaming, because they're a big difference between now and like the 16-bit era is we didn't have the internet. We didn't have all of these distractions. We didn't have all of this stuff that could take our time. Yeah. And I think one of the mistakes that a lot of current developers and publishers are making is that they seem to act like they're making games in a vacuum. I have so many other entertainment options now that I did not have 10 years ago. So where I, you know, these games that I'm playing, they really need to do something. They need to do something unique. They need to do something awesome. They need to be able to catch my attention in order for me to keep going. And I think that's the other reason why you see the AAA model sort of imploding on itself, because you do that style of checklist gaming where you're just putting this stuff in there to check that box. People have seen that stuff before.
Yeah.
And so that, I think that's the other thing that we're seeing come out of this. And so that makes companies like CD Projekt so much more important, because they're not buying into that bullshit.
No.
Mm-mm.
Hell, I mean, they delayed The Witcher because they were like, we just need to polish it more.
Yeah.
Because they realized that they put out a bad product that will haunt them forever. Look at what happened with 343. Yeah. You know, they're not going to be able to recover from that stuff.
Delays These guys are temporary, know that mediocrity is forever.
Exactly. And, you know, Blizzard was one of those. Blizzard, I think, almost got into a situation that Square was in. But I think Blizzard blew a lot of goodwill with what happened with Diablo 3. The lead designer was antagonistic towards their audience. They had a game that the loot said, you know, the whole point of Diablo is getting loot. And getting loot wasn't fun. The shortcut was let me go around and just buy what I need so I can progress. Or so I can progress through the game. And, you know, there were so many people that came out and they were just like, yes, I bought it, and this is just not what I wanted. This was bad. That they ended up kicking the guy out, and they got a whole new team on. And the very first thing that team did was release a patch that essentially fixed the game. And I think Blizzard realized in a time frame that maybe like a company like Square would not have, they realized, holy shit, we're at the cusp of actually losing the goodwill that our customers have towards us.
Yeah.
And so they righted that ship. CD Projekt, another group of people, they were like, we know if we release this and we pull a 343 or we pull an Ubisoft like with Assassin's Creed Unity, that this is going to damage us. And we don't have these other properties to fall back on. This is the big mama for us. Yeah. So, yeah, it definitely matters who's making it, because, God, I don't trust so many of these companies. It almost makes me feel bad like when I say it out loud, like, are these guys really out to fuck me? Because it feels like they are.
Yeah.
I don't think you should feel bad to say it. I think it's a reasonable concern for the industry the way it is.
Well, yeah, like even going back to what we were talking about with Mortal Kombat, where the season pass is like $50. It's like, really? You know, but again, you're also towing that line. Like, I understand that these are businesses. They have people they have to pay. You know, this isn't – gaming doesn't get made for the altruistic reason of I want to create art. People need to, you know, put food on their table. Yeah. They need to be able to take care of their families and still try and, you know, make something that people want to buy. But at the same time, they're so thin of a line that these developers continuously cross over, I think. That it does make companies like Blizzard and CD Projekt, I think, more important than ever. Because for every one of those guys, there's 15 other companies that aren't doing it right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's also kind of a shame, like Pat was talking about the crew. Nothing in that game really requires that you be connected all the time. But you have to be.
Nope.
No.
Yeah.
And it's a game that I would have kept and probably played the shit out of if it hadn't been for that one thing. And, you know, when I buy a game, I buy it with the intentions of being able to go back to it years down the road if I feel so inclined. Right. And if I can't do that, then I get pretty pissed off.
Yeah. Well, as you should. I mean, it's kind of It seems like there's like two or three of these really, you know, bad actors that have kind of influenced a whole bunch of other companies.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and you know what it is too. I mean, it's chasing that short-term dollar and not really that, you know, getting that stock jump and everything else like that, and not really thinking about the damage that will cost. I mean, you have a lot of gamers, especially when we talk about choice and things like that. I mean, I think there is a real fatigue for a lot of these games. And you know, same thing, going full circle back to the Tony Hawk stuff. I mean, they were pimping that out, and then eventually people got tired of it and they stopped buying it completely.
Yeah. Well, I think that was what started the whole annualization trend at Activision.
Yeah.
That was the series that did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they've just kind of moved on from what can we annualize to what can we annualize. And you have, you know, at least, you know, I give Ubisoft credit for as many annual franchises that they have. They still do stuff like Valiant Hearts. They still do stuff like Child of Light. And so they at least are sort of balancing it out. I don't think you really see that from Activision. And I can't really be mad at that either, because if that's what their audience is and that's what's keeping people working, you know, that's what they're going to do. But at the same time, I think it's one of those trends that overall for the industry is problematic, simply because you're selling sort of a similar game and you're just kind of retweaking. I mean, Madden does the same thing every single year. And there's an audience for that. But I also have to wonder, too, with how big these games get, that dilution of the product. I mean, I think it's just bad. I don't think it's good for the industry at all.
Yeah. I think that's why we're seeing, like, Joe Montana getting up in up in the game.
And getting attention.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, God, would anyone have thought 5 years ago that people like Joe Montana? Joe Montana football. Wow.
Yeah.
You know?
Could people 5 years ago think that freaking Battletoads would be coming back?
No.
Yeah.
All indications seem like that's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's really the worst kept secret in the industry right now.
Yeah. But I do think this is all just in general. I think that everything that we're seeing, I mean, even just the stuff that we've talked about in this podcast is so systematic of an industry that really is in flux. And it's really trying to figure out what to do. Because, I mean, you know, on one hand, we have a lot of gloom and doomers that are like, there's not going to be any more consoles. We have people that believe, and I think rightly so, that there's very possible that, you know, over the next two generations, we might not even see handheld hardware anymore because of the ubiquitousness of things like iPads and Android tablets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think those are real things to be concerned about. The fact that we have Nintendo now teaming with DNA to do mobile stuff, something that they have been so against for so long, like this is where we are going. And thankfully, though, I do think, you know, going back to what we were talking about before, at least you have people like, you know, companies like Square where they're like, we were successful doing this kind of thing and we lost our route. You know, we lost our way doing this other stuff. Let's try and get back to that and see if we can find those successes again.
Yeah.
So I, you know, hopefully this is the industry sort of righting itself. The indies are filling in that middle that fell out in the last generation. There was really, I think, one of those things that helped the industry be healthy. If you didn't have those B-tier games, we wouldn't have got stuff like Suikoden. I honestly think arguably we wouldn't have gotten something like Symphony of the Night, you know, which is one of those games that's considered classic. Simply because it was there was a period where people could take a chance and it didn't cost that much money to do so.
Yeah.
Whereas now, taking a chance, the reason we see this annualization is because taking a chance will close your company down if it fails.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah.
Because I'm old.
I just recommend everybody play.
And we're getting older.
Play Game Dev Tycoon. It really puts all of this into a very crystal clear focus.
Yeah. Didn't they put something in there where if you pirated the game, God, I read about this. Like if they pirated the game, you
go bankrupt very quickly.
Yes, you go bankrupt quickly. That's what it was. Yeah. Oh man.
Yeah. I like when devs do stuff like that. I mean, it's just.
And then when they go on Twitter to to inevitably complain about the bug in their game. They just added like, themselves as pirates.
Yeah, it's good times, man.
Yeah, quite a few of these companies do that. I think Rocksteady did that for the Arkham games.
Yeah, wasn't it like with the Catwoman, you couldn't get out of her apartment or something?
Yeah.
Well, that's what they
you couldn't that. Play her, period.
Yeah.
You couldn't play her, period.
Yeah. And there was also, like, if you, I think it was in Arkham Asylum, if you pirated the PC version, there was a certain point where you, after the game would save, you could never load it again.
So. Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I don't want to be one of those people that acts like, you know, these guys don't have a right to make money, but I also, part of me wonders, like, internally if I'm sort of part of the problem, because I don't buy games on launch anymore, and it's strictly because of time. And what the other thing is that I, from a value proposition as a consumer, it doesn't make a lot of sense for me to buy stuff day one when even 30 days past that you'll see the price drop, you know, by $20 to $30.
Yeah.
And then you couple that with the annualization. I mean, I think like for Assassin's Creed and stuff like that, I might just buy, like, when the new one comes out, I'll just wait until the next year and then buy that one when the other new one comes out, you know, like instead of buying Madden 16, I'll buy Madden 15, like that kind of stuff, because there's not going to be that much difference between them anyway.
Yeah.
And I, on one hand, it makes me feel bad. Like, I love the video game industry, I want to see it thrive, but at the same time, I don't feel like the asking price of that $60, particularly for what I'm going to get out of it, I don't feel like there's any equilibrium there.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like if I'm paying that much out of the box, I'm getting the short end of the stick. So, but then I will turn around with stuff like Axiom Verge or whatever. I bought that the minute it came out. You know, the stuff that, what was it, Supergiant was doing with Transistor and Bastion, day one, you know?
But I really hope to hear what they're doing next pretty soon.
I do too, because they're doing some magic, man. Their games are fantastic.
There is something special going on at that studio.
I said it in one of the podcasts a few weeks ago. It feels like these guys have the old Rare magic from years gone by.
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually a really good – that's a really good comparison, I think. And but the same thing, like that goodwill. They've put out two really good products, you know, there's a – you know what it is too, I think, with their stuff? There's that level – particularly with the art. There's that level of care there, you know, that you can just see. It's just – and it's not a money thing. Like, you can play those games where the textures are so super sharp, you can just be like, wow, it must have cost them $300 to render this or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But you just look at, like, some of the art in their stuff, just with Bastion alone, and then they jacked it up 15 notches with Transistor. I mean, there's a level of love in that creation that you're not seeing in a lot of these other games. The Axiom Verge is the same thing, even though it's like, you know, old school 8-bit style, you know, style graphics, there is a certain a love that's there that you don't see in these big games.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think, and what's interesting to me is that I think you can see that in big games. Like, WoW has fantastic art direction. GTA 5, I know a lot of people don't like GTA. I'm a huge fan of Grand Theft Auto, because I don't think anybody creates worlds the way that Rockstar does. I can literally just load up that game and watch random shit happen. The little details that are in that game are astonishing. Like, if you play with headphones and you park your car in the garage, you can hear the tink, tink, tink sound that engines make when they've been turned off after running. You know, there's so many little details that they put in that game that is, you know, you can see that there's that love there. And so it can definitely be in AAA titles as well. But I think we're definitely seeing it more on the indie scene. But, you know, anybody can do it, but, like, I don't see that stuff in the Assassin's Creed games or anything else like that. I just feel like these are games designed specifically as a monetary exchange at this point.
Yeah.
And that really bothers me.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully.
I'm old.
I think we got a show.
Yeah, we definitely have a show. I'm going to have a hell of a time editing this together.
Yeah, good luck.
Yeah, have fun with that, Phil.
Just let me know how much footage we need after the after the fact, and I'll get that for you.
Yeah, you might be able to capture about 2 hours. I should be all right with that.
You will be in our thoughts and prayers.
Yeah. Well, with that, I'm Filippo D'Onofrio.
I'm Patrick Mifflin.
I'm Brandon Perkins.
And I'm old.
We'll see you next week.